Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
My father passed away last year, August 28th. And I was terminated in the middle of September. My husband left in October. My father's birthday was October 10th. And then right after his birthday, I tested positive for COVID.
That's Charmaine Hunter Spencer, a licensed substance abuse counselor from Atascocita, Texas.
I depleted my savings, you know, just trying to hold on to the very last income that I had saved from working and just trying to make sure the rent was paid.
Charmaine's rent was $1,500 a month for a three-bedroom house for her and her two college-age sons. Those savings didn't last long. By February, she was in arrears, and she then learned she could apply for emergency rental assistance. The application with the county-based Houston-Harris Help went seamlessly at first.
Thank you for calling the Houston-Harris County Emergency Rental Assistance Program. This program offers rental and utilities assistance for people who are experiencing financial hardship due to the COVID-19 pandemic. This is not a
About 3 months later, and I remember calling Harris Hill, and I never heard from anyone as far as the agency was concerned with following up with me.
Applications are selected at random for processing by Baker Ripley and Catholic Charities. For more information about the program,
couldn't speak with anyone. That was extremely depressing. Finally, when I did speak with someone, I had to push a number stating as if I would already have been approved for someone to come on the phone. And the young lady answered the line and she took my information and she said, "Well, ma'am, I apologize, but your case has not even been worked on." I had been applying for positions and I was grieving. So it was somewhat as, I don't know, I was mentally fatigued and emotionally fatigued. But I remember applying. At that moment, I was saying to myself, yes, I may have a master's degree. I may have this, I may have that. But at this point in my life, I'm just ready to work. But the stores were not open at that time. Walmart had just opened, and my son was working at Walmart, so he would help pay, you know, with the bills. I would make arrangements. My mother would help. My husband would help, even though we were not together, you know. So that helped as far as the bills. But the rent, no. I couldn't pay rent. And there were even times where, you know, the lights were cut off or, you know, the water was off. I applied in February and they awarded me the middle of June. And that was only to cover up to May. So that is why I was trying to, you know, contact them and say, hey, you know, I need the additional funds. I haven't found a job. I plan to utilize my tax return and I haven't received the second stimulus. So I'm going to combine those and hopefully, you know, 3 months, I'm okay. I have where I'm able to see clients on the side. However, there are extra certificates that are needed, like battered intervention, things of that nature, that will help me with upward mobility. So that's what I was planning on utilizing my income tax return for that. But I'm not. I'm going to use it for my rent because I don't want to go back through this. I'd just rather do without as far as going back through the agency. And I'm not. I'm done. I am done.
That's Charmaine Hunter Spencer, a licensed substance abuse counselor from Atascocita, Texas. Charmaine said she did eventually receive additional assistance through the state-based Texas Rent Relief Program to cover her through September. After that, well, she'll figure it out. Ann Oliva joins us now. She's the Vice President for Housing Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She also spent 10 years at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, most recently as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Special Needs. Ann, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you heard Charmaine's story, and she did receive rental assistance eventually, but the process, as she said, left her mentally fatigued. Then there are millions of Americans who haven't received any at all. Can you paint us a picture of the situation? How much of this federal aid has been distributed so far?
Sure. So yesterday, the Department of the Treasury released the most recent information that we have on the number of households who've received assistance and the amount of funding that's spent. So this emergency rental assistance was actually passed in two tranches. So for the purposes of this conversation, I will talk about ERA 1, which is the money, the $25 billion that was passed in December. And then there was a second tranche of close to that same amount as part of the American Rescue Plan. So Treasury's data yesterday indicates that an additional $1.7 billion was spent on rent, utilities, and arrears in the month of July. So a little more than 341,000 households were assisted. So that brings us to close to a million households assisted across the country, and about 21% of the ERA 1 funding fully expended.
So that's still such a small amount when you think about the overall need and how long people have been out of work, unemployed, like Charmaine. Help me and our listeners understand, why is it taking so long for the majority of this money to be expended?
Yeah, so the first thing I want to note is that our hardship data, the data that's published by the census, it's called the Pulse Survey, the data that we looked at between the end of June and beginning of July indicates that there's about 11.4 million households, rental households, that were not caught up on rent. And close to half of those 11.4 million indicated that they thought that they were possibly going to be evicted in the next 2 months. So that's, again, that is a big difference between the 1 million that have been served so far and the 11.4 who have indicated that they're behind on rent. And we know that, this type of hardship also does not sort of evenly affect everybody. Renters of color consistently have hardship rates that are like 2 or 2.5 times that of white renters. And we know that renters with children, 21% of renters who are parents or live with children, reported that they weren't caught up on rent. So this is having a really big impact on communities of color and people who have kids.
Well, I was going to ask, what are the reasons why there is this backlog? Is it a logistical issue with how the applications are being received and processed? Is it that there's not enough manpower at the city and state agencies to process them? Sort of help us find out where the system is breaking down.
Sure. So just to give folks a sense of scale, the largest homelessness or eviction prevention program that was ever funded at the federal level, it was funded in 2009 as part of the Great Recession, was $1.5 billion. And we are now talking about close to $50 billion. So the scale of the crisis is unprecedented. And the scale of the resources that the federal government is putting forward is also unprecedented. So there are some challenges, logistical challenges and capacity challenges that run all the way from the federal government staff down to local nonprofits who are administering these dollars. So there are things like being able to have enough staff. Folks at the local level had to have enough staff in place in order to process applications. They had to build technology in order to get applications from the public. They had to conduct outreach to highly impacted communities. All of this takes a lot of person power and capacity. So that's part of the problem that we're seeing here. It is just very hard to build a program like this from scratch.
And this program that, as you said, was built from scratch, it's being administered by hundreds of different emergency rental assistance organizations on the local level. Would it be a better idea just to have this be run by the federal government, a federal agency that is more centralized to carry this out?
I think that want to just note that what we really need to do is to ensure that we don't have to do this in an emergency again. So it's not necessarily about where the program is centralized. It's about having a long-term solution that will allow communities to expand and contract capacity when there is a crisis that we need to address. And we at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities believe really strongly that that should be done through the Housing Choice Voucher Program. And an expansion to that program would make a huge difference in the next crisis.
Okay, we'll talk more about that on the other side of our break. We're discussing the difficulties of distributing federal aid on rental assistance. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking about the federal aid on rental assistance and why only 11% of the allocated $46.5 billion has been distributed. We're joined by Anne Oliva. She's Vice President for Housing Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She also spent 10 years at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And also joining us now is Bobby Wilkinson, Executive Director at the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. Bobby, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Kimberly.
So give us an example of what is happening in Texas right now. We heard Charmaine's story at the top of the hour, but talk about how Texas's program for distributing this emergency rental assistance started off.
It started off slowly, and we stumbled out of the gate. We tried to be prepared as we saw the bill being formed. You know, the president signed it at the end of last year, and the money kind of flew out the door from the federal treasury to our state treasury, and we went through an emergency procurement process, got a big vendor set up, and I think we got the money maybe in one or two tranches in mid to late January, and we had the vendor selected February 1, launched our website February 7th, started taking applications February 15th. And so that sounds good. And when we were happy to be moving so quickly, but then we stumbled that, it wasn't quite what we thought it would be as far as how long it would take, you know, reviewing applications. And, we had some software issues. We had to basically start over in March with a new software system that was actually capable of processing all the intake. And, you know, that it put us behind. And so we just added resources. We could use up to 10% for admin. And so we added some additional contractors and staffed up internally as well to try to make all the changes we need and use enough employees to get it all done.
And Bobby, did you feel like you had enough guidance to be able to adapt in the way that you're talking about once there were stumbles to try to address them? Did you feel like there was any guidance there for the folks in your department to make those adaptations?
I think Treasury's done a pretty good job of listening and then continuing to update guidance fairly quickly. I mean, this is a new and novel program for everyone. Some folks had done some rental assistance with some CARES Act money, but for the most part, this was the first kind of nationwide big rental assistance program that any of us had done. And it was new to Treasury as well, and so they were in a hurry, and so they've came out quickly with some guidance, the previous administration and then the new one. And then now they've, you know, several times, I've lost count of how many times we've had new guidance, but it's a good thing because they've been responding, trying to, you know, change policy to get money out the door. It was actually updated yesterday again. So we're reviewing that and going to probably make some changes to our application as a result.
So you've been able to adapt and be able to follow these federal guidelines, but not everyone has been able to do so quite so smoothly. Some other localities have really been struggling. Have you talked to people in other states and cities and gotten an idea of what the problems there are?
I have, mostly with other state programs, but I have heard from some locals. Houston-Harris County actually it has pretty good numbers. So they had a strong model where they partnered with two like really big nonprofits that were very capable, Catholic Charities and Baker Ripley. I know others have had a harder time, maybe some small locations where the 10% didn't amount to as much as far as their ability to administer. Some states, you know, they had to wait on leadership for guidance. Some states had to wait on their legislatures. Some states had to go through a more formal procurement process. And, you know, with the support of our governor, we were able to move quickly at the beginning. And, I think we've been pretty quick to just look at the new guidance, make decisions, and then, you know, put that into action. There's always a lag, though, you know, especially if you have to change your software, your application, you have to retrain reviewers. And so, you know, there's always a lag on implementation, and then, you know, then the reviewers have to take time to get better at their jobs. And we'd hoped for more of like a, you know, artificial intelligence type solution with processing, and it takes a lot of eyeballs and brains and talking on the phone with tenants and to get these applications right to get the money out the door.
So, Anne, what is it that makes it more difficult for some states and localities to be able to follow these guidelines and get these things in place and makes it easier for others?
So every state and locality has different particular housing situations. They have communities that are particularly impacted that they want to make sure they're outreaching to. And as Bobby sort of talked about, there are different processes in all these states and localities. Some have to go through their legislature or city council in order to move a new program forward. Some have more flexibility. So, you know, there's just a number of different ways that this program was going to have to be rolled out in different states. I know, for example, in some states, the state program is trying really hard to work with the localities that have received funding so that they have consistent procedures. So it's not so confusing for people who are in need, the tenants and the landlords who need relief. So there are a number of local stumbling blocks.
And you spoke before about the fact that when there's not explicit guidelines in place, sometimes the people who administer these programs tend to default to the most difficult or cumbersome process. Explain that a little bit.
Sure. So there is always when, and I'm sure that Bobby can talk about this as well, but there is always sort of a calculation about how flexible you can be or how open an application process is versus the possibility of your state inspector general or federal monitors coming and reviewing your processes and saying that they weren't in compliance with the regs or the guidance. And so every locality is going to make that calculation a little bit differently depending on their relationship with their inspector general or other relationships. So I think what happens is when there is not explicit guidance, a lot of localities will be quite risk averse and not really be willing to do something like self-attestation or self-certification because they think they might have to pay that money back later.
I see. Bobby, is that something that you experienced in Texas?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, you always worry about both fraud, waste, and abuse for its own sake and then getting dinged in an audit. Having to owe the federal government back money is an issue for folks. I think maybe Texas was a little better positioned mindset wise for a new and novel emergency program because we have so many disasters. So we're experienced with responding to hurricanes and such. So I think we were ready to get moving on this one. If you look at the numbers, though, a lot of the states now, you know, the more recent months are much better than they were in March, April, and May. Everyone, I think, is for the most part ramping up.
And that is probably in part and because there is the September 30th deadline coming up for distributing these funds. How do you think this factors in, Anne?
So I think that there are a few things that factor in. I would agree that folks are working through the challenges in their local implementations. I also think in some areas, like I believe in the state of Illinois, they opened their program. They took a lot of applications on the front end, and then they closed it while they were processing all those applications, and they've gotten through that backlog. I think that's happening in a number of states. So the flip side of this conversation is about what happens at the federal level when there are states or localities that are not spending their money as quickly as they should be. And the federal government in their guidance that they issued yesterday, in their revision that they issued yesterday, did note that, they would potentially be recapturing excess funds that haven't been obligated by a state or other grantee and reallocating those funds to other jurisdictions who are moving their money more quickly.
And that September 30th deadline, which, as you said, allows the Treasury Department to reallocate funds in some places. Bobby, do you think that's going to affect you in Texas?
I would imagine we would be a receiver of a reallocation rather than a giver, which, I'd be glad to take it. We definitely have a need here and we can spend it.
And why do you think that? I mean, why do you think that is? Why do you just again the ability, since you have been able to spend enough of the cash to keep it and qualify for that reallocation, while other people just have not been able to get to that place? What do you think are some other obstacles we haven't talked about yet?
Frankly, some of the more lightly populated states might not have a big enough need to spend their small state minimum. You know, they just probably don't have enough renters at 80% AMI or below that are in trouble with the rent at all. So that's one issue. And then, the other things that we talked about as far as just, for some people didn't start right away. They took time setting up their program for various reasons. Sometimes it was their, leadership or their legislature, sometimes not. But I think everyone's kind of moving in the right direction now.
Do you think there's more that the Treasury could have done to help?
Oh, hindsight's 20/20. I mean, you're not going to have a brand new program that comes out fully formed with guidance, and the emergency nature of it would kind of prevent you from having such guidance and foresight. It's hard to second guess. Sure, there could have been some additional guidance or looser guidance on approvals at the beginning. It was kind of a trial and error, though. They were building the plane while they were flying it, just like all the states as well.
And what do you think? Is there more that the federal government could have done to encourage people to get these programs up and moving in a more efficient way?
The guidance that Treasury issued yesterday, I think, is the most explicit that they've provided in terms of what kind of flexibility they are requiring or encouraging their grantees to utilize during this public health emergency. So, I think that, I agree with Bobby, like second guessing what they have done is not super helpful, but I know that yesterday's guidance was the most explicit that they've been around how local grantees can be utilizing those flexibilities in order to move money more quickly. They're also at this point pointing to communities that are doing a good job and posting their examples up on their website, which I think is going to be super helpful for communities that maybe have not gotten that far yet. But again, I think that it's really important for us to think about the long term in this situation and really focus in on what the federal government should be doing now is thinking about how we can avert this kind of crisis in the future and how we can expand the programs that we know already work and that work well for families and individuals that I think 60% of the folks who are being served through this program, through the ERA program, are below 30% of area median income. That means that they are extremely low income households. And that's exactly the type of household that the Housing Choice Voucher Program targets. So it feels like we need to do both.
We have a question from on Twitter from a listener who essentially asks whether politics are at play here. And it's a concern that perhaps because this money is being distributed in the Biden administration, perhaps some states might be slow rolling this in an effort to harm the president. Do you see that as a potential cause?
So unfortunately, I think that a lot of things that maybe weren't politicized in the past are politicized now. I haven't seen personally any indication that a state or locality is, slow rolling implementation to harm this administration. But what I have seen is that there are philosophical and political differences that happen at the local level, especially if you have mixed legislature and governor, for example, or mixed city council and mayor. So that politicization is playing out at the local level as these programs are being designed, and that's definitely a possibility in terms of how things are rolling out and why they might be slower.
Bobby, is that a factor you see happening in Texas at all?
I mean, I don't think that squares with the data. If you look at, the July Treasury data and kind of trying to sort it by, percentage out the door or whatever, the state of Texas is a red state, the biggest red state, and we are number one in dollars out the door and number two in percentage of awards comparing to other states, not to locals. We're not slow rolling. So it might be a possibility somewhere, but I doubt it. These kind of programs don't tend to be used as a political football in quite that way.
And Bobby, what would you encourage people who still have not received this funding to do?
Be careful with your application. Read through it carefully. Make sure you have a good phone number and email address on it. Communicate with your landlord and make sure that they know that you've applied. Be realistic on your expectation. You're not going to apply and just get the money the next week. It's going to take some time, a month maybe.
All right.
There's thousands of people that are applying every day.
All right. Bobby Wilkinson is executive director of the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. Bobby, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are talking about the federal aid for rental assistance. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. We're talking today about the struggle to distribute federal aid for rental assistance. According to the Treasury's latest data, only 11% of the $46.5 billion have been distributed as of July 31st. We've been looking at this at a state and national level so far, but let's take a moment to look at one of the early local efforts to distribute rental assistance. Kathy Garcia is a community organizer at Chainbreaker Collective, an economic and environmental justice group based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. She told us that in November last year, the city received funds as a result of the CARES Act for direct cash assistance, and her organization was tasked with distributing $2 million by December 31st.
Our base were the folks who were experiencing disproportionate threats of eviction and who were already disproportionately rent burdened. So we knew that in reaching out to our members and the neighborhoods where our members live, that we could really get that money targeted to the communities that needed it most immediately. That $2 million was distributed in about a month.
And Kathy says the key was to keep the process as simple as possible.
The application only had five questions, only had a handful of questions, and it only required uploading two documents, a photo ID and a self-attestation form, which was basically an affidavit that said, I swear I need this money and I swear I'm going to use it on appropriate expenses. This money was then sent directly to families' bank accounts or via cash card. So it was immediate. We had people who applied one day, let's say on a Monday, they had money in their account by Friday.
Kathy says the program also ensured the application was easily accessible through phones to bridge the digital divide that had hotlines to help those, and she had hotlines to help those who had any questions. As a state, New Mexico has only distributed a fraction of their allocated federal aid on rental assistance. Kathy says that has been an insult to the families that are struggling.
We need to trust our community. We know that our communities are suffering, and yet we're still making them jump through all these hoops at a time when everyone is so demoralized and tired, and when it is exactly these communities who have also felt the disproportionate brunt of COVID death. We haven't even had an opportunity to mourn and heal as a community, and now we're saying, beg for these funds.
That's Kathy Garcia, a community organizer at Santa Fe-based Chain Breaker Collective. And talk to us about how important the role of these on-the-ground local efforts like Chain Breaker Collective have been in helping distribute the rental assistance.
I think, thank you for talking with Kathy and including that in today's discussion, because I think that she hit a number of things right on the head. It is incredibly important that we are using these funds to address the disparities that I talked about early on in this segment about the number of families that are impacted and disproportionately impacted, the communities of color that are disproportionately impacted. And the folks who can reach those households are usually the NGOs or nonprofit organizations that are on the ground that have relationships in community to be able to address the needs that they see in their communities. It just feels like such an important piece of this discussion.
And is that, I mean, we talked briefly earlier when I asked, should there be a more centralized sort of method in distributing this? And you made the very good point that the real priority should be preventing this kind of emergency to begin with. But just talk a little more about the differences in having these local community-based organizations and how different it would look if it was a federal centralized program.
Yeah, I think that the beauty of an organization like the one that you just spotlighted in the Santa Fe area is, again, that they actually know sort of neighborhood by neighborhood who is suffering, who is really impacted. And while we can do that work and we have maps available that can show planners where the most impacted neighborhoods are by census tract, you don't actually have relationships at the federal level with those communities and trusting relationships that can help speed the release of these funds to the folks who really need it most.
So how prepared do you think that cities and states are in the event that there are additional problems that exacerbate the problems? I'm thinking, for example, that there is currently an eviction moratorium that has been extended, but that might be reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court, by people who are challenging that. In the event that you have another crisis that exacerbates this crisis, how ready are cities and states to deal with what could be even more need?
Yeah, I think it's, again, different in different places across the country, but this is something that we are very worried about. There are sort of three big items that folks can be working on at the state and local level, and that's local and state moratoria. I know places like the District of Columbia and Minnesota have stronger state and local moratoria in place than the CDC. So they do have some additional protections already in place. There are some communities really working to implement through their court system eviction diversion programs. So for example, when an eviction comes up in front of a judge, that judge can connect the tenant or landlord with the emergency rental assistance program to ensure that that those funds are being used to divert that eviction. And again, as we've been talking about for this entire program, speeding up getting that emergency rental assistance out the door into the hands of landlords and tenants who really need it.
So we heard Bobby mention that one factor he thinks that helped Texas sort of turn around their program after early stumbles was the fact that Texas is used to disasters. They're used to hurricanes and floods and power outages. Talk about some of the things that you've seen in other states that have sort of been able to get back on their feet and do a better job at these allocations. What sort of factors are in place in these states that have been able to make those changes?
I would say the most important things that I've seen change over the last few months is streamlining the actual application process. That the idea that you could have an application that's only five questions and it works. Probably other folks in other states probably need to listen to that. I've seen a number of applications at the state and local level that ask a lot of questions that are not necessarily relevant to whether somebody is in rental arrears or utility arrears right now. So streamlining those application processes, addressing the technology, making sure that it's working, that it's not glitchy, and that there are multiple ways for people who need these resources to access the application. Bobby did talk about like doing it over the phone and having walk-ins and other options for folks who don't have a PC or a computer to use. Make sure that they could do it from their phones. And the other thing that I would just that we touched on a little bit is outreach, outreach, outreach. There are some people who aren't even aware that this program is available to them. And conducting outreach in multiple languages, conducting specific outreach to communities and neighborhoods that have been really highly impacted. We have the data to be able to do that. And I hope that states and localities can continue to really have robust outreach efforts to reach those tenants who really need this assistance.
I want you to talk a little bit more about that, because you mentioned at the top that a lot of the problems we see can exacerbate the already existing inequities, right? You're saying that, for example, Black families are 2 to 2.5 times more likely to need this assistance than families with young children. In what ways can you do that outreach? I mean, I'm sure in some it involves language access. But how else can people really reach out to these different communities to make sure that they have that information?
Yeah, I think that Kathy really talked about how they're doing that in New Mexico. Really, the most critical piece is to partner with nonprofits and maybe smaller non-traditional nonprofits and churches who are embedded in communities that are highly impacted and that have trusting relationships with their community members and can get the word out very quickly through multiple means. Certainly, we want to make sure that the materials are available in multiple languages and that you have intake workers that speak multiple languages. But really, it's making sure that the outreach efforts are concentrated in those areas where the data shows us that there is high need. And in a lot of areas, it's also neighborhoods that have been historically marginalized. So areas that were subject to redlining or covenants a long time ago often still have the effects of those racist policies.
So we're coming up on that September 30th deadline when the Treasury can reallocate some of those funds where they haven't been spent. Do you think there's enough time? Can some of these places that are potentially subject to that, to losing that money, do they have time to turn the ship around?
I think the answer is I don't know. I think that for communities that have already started to work through those challenges, they have some time to make the changes that they need to, or to continue on a path that they need to. There are a number of places that went from zero and that really have started to pick up the pace of their implementation. I mentioned the state of Illinois. We saw an uptick in Illinois, in large part probably because they were able to get through the backlog of applications. So I do think that there's hope for communities that have already started those processes. For others, I do think that that they're at risk of losing their funding, or at least a portion of their funding, on September 30th.
So, and what are, talk about some specific things, particularly at the state level. I mean, we talked a lot about a lot of the innovation that's happening with nonprofits and on the local level. But for folks in states who aren't doing as well as Bobby in Texas and implementing that program, what are some just points that they should start focusing on now as this September 30th deadline looms?
If I were in a state that were that was not performing as well, one, I would want to talk to other states, leaders in other states that do have really successful implementations and learn from them. The Treasury is starting to put examples that they think are good up on their website so communities can take a look at those examples and adapt them for their local use. But that would be the first thing that I would want to do if I was a state leader, is really learn from what's happening in Texas and California and Virginia and other states that are doing well and see what they've done and what you can be implemented quickly in my own state. I also think that folks, again, need to partner with their local grantees and the nonprofit organizations who are getting this money out on the ground to understand what the challenges are at that level, at the granular level, so they can address them as quickly as possible. And also listen to the people who are impacted. Ask people who are impacted by this crisis, who are behind on rent, what's helpful. Ask landlords what's helpful and take that advice and implement it in your own program.
Can the Treasury play a bigger role here? I mean, do they have any ability to help the people, help the states and localities that have this money distribute it? Might they grant waivers for the deadline, for example? Is there anything that the Treasury can do to sort of ease this crunch as this deadline approaches?
So the Treasury does have the ability to decide whether they are going to reallocate funds or not. So they don't have to issue waivers. But what they can do also is partner with, for example, the Department of Housing and Urban Development that does have very big rental assistance programs like the Housing Choice Voucher Program, and work with them to provide technical assistance to those grantees that are lagging behind so that they can help to figure out what's happening, what the challenges are, what the barriers are, and send in some experts that can help those communities overcome those barriers.
And given your experience at the center, at HUD, I know this was an unprecedented amount federal aid program that in its size. But are you surprised at the hurdles that it seems a lot of these states and localities have had in distributing this money at a time when so many people have such a dire need?
I don't know that surprised is the word that I would use. I know from my own professional experience how hard it is to set up this type of program and design a program at a scale, not even at this scale, how hard that is to design it from scratch. What I would say is that I am concerned that there are still a number of states this far in that have not addressed those challenges locally and are still very low in terms of their expenditure rate. They have to do more.
Yeah. And in those states, what would people who are seeking this money, what should the individuals do? Is there anything they can do?
They can talk to their legislature, their governor's office, and they can, apply in multiple areas if those are available to them. But I'm not sure that this is something that those tenants can really affect. It has to be done with the grantees.
Okay. Anne Oliva is the Vice President for Housing Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She spent 10 years with HUD and most recently as Deputy Assistant for Special Needs. Anne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.